You're listening to the Agony Column News Report, featuring interviews, phone interviews, reports from live book events and festivals, and conversations with readers. You can find additional news, interviews, book reviews, and more 5 days a week at the Agony Column website at trashotron.com/agony. Stephen Graham Jones is the author of The Only Good Indians, the Indian Lake trilogy, which consists of My Heart is a Chainsaw, Don't Fear the Reaper, and The Angel of Indian Lake. His newest novel is I Was a Teenage Slasher. Thank you for joining me, Stephen.
Thrilled to be here. Thanks for having me.
You know, I'm going to reach back almost 50 years to 1975 when the movie Jaws appeared. And I think changed the monster genre mostly for the worse, to be truthful, because it set forth a template for monsters and killers that has lasted till this day, which is that these things are killing machines. That makes them, on one hand, very scary. And we've had Jason, The Shade, Michael Myers. We've had the alien, all referred to as killing machines. This is makes them very fearsome, but on the other hand, it makes them somewhat uninteresting because they just kill you. They don't care. They just want to kill whatever's in front of them. And what you have done with this novel is single-handedly created a whole new genre of fiction that is based upon and extends all these killing machine humans, the slasher novels, by creating, by giving the monster a perception. This is a slasher novel told from the point of view of the slasher. What made you take that trip?
First, yeah, I like that killing machine you were talking about, that way of understanding these killing machines. And I wonder if James Cameron's Terminator in 84 was like the height of that, you know, because that was literally a killing machine, and that's all it did, you know.
Exactly.
It's like a lawnmower dropped into a crowd, you know, or something. But what made me do this was, I mean, I wish I had some grand plan or ideals or strategy, but I needed to clear my head before I wrote The Angel of Indian Lake, and because I wanted The Angel of Indian Lake to be about people, and so I needed a place in a story where I could talk about slashers. And so not having a lot of time to prepare for it, you know, like 2 hours, I went back home to West Texas, and I went back to a time I know, 1989, when I was also 17. People, you know, my editor tells me he thought that because with the Indian Lake trilogy, I was looking at it from the perspective of the final girl, that it makes sense I would kind of pivot to tell a story from the slasher side, just to kind of get a full view of the slasher genre. And I wish I could claim that, but I'm not quite that intelligent, you know? So I just thought it would be fun, really. And, but although those films you were talking about, they were my models, my challenges, my inspirations. Specifically, if I can cite a single like triggering mechanism for me for writing teenage slasher, it would either be Nightmare on Elm Street Part 2, where Jesse is also transforming into a slasher with Freddy Krueger is like ripping out from his stomach and all that, or more immediate, more close would be Cabin in the Woods from 2011, because that to me was just revolutionary. It was so intelligent. It proposed a new scaffolding behind this whole genre that we thought we knew. And I love that, but I kept wondering over the last decade, is that the final word, or is there another way to do this? And finally with Teenage Slasher, I figured out another way to do it, another way to propose a different kind of scaffolding behind this genre we know and love.
One of the things I have to say about this book as I read it was how beautifully written it is. It was just a joy to read, just the words on the page and the way you laid out this story. The beginning struck me as reading, in a sense, like The Breakfast Club as directed by Alfred Hitchcock.
Oh, that's nice. I like that. That's such a complimentary way to phrase it.
And just as I read it too, it felt like a really personal novel. Like this was you yourself were really invested in it. And as, in a sense, it felt like an off-sung autobiography, you know, a slanted autobiography. Was there a lot of you in this novel and in Tolly Driver?
There is. I mean, in all my novels, there's a lot of me, but in some novels, it's a lot more obvious, or like I accidentally leave too much of myself behind, it feels like, you know? And I feel like it's what I did with Tolly Driver. I mean, not just because I was also 17 in West Texas in 1989, but the way he thinks is very much the way I thought when I was 17, or the way that from 52 years old, the way I remember I thought when I was 17. I don't know if my 17-year-old self would claim it or not, you know?
You know, talk about just creating the beginning of this, because you do a wonderful job of showing the very complex dynamics of teenage society in an American high school. It is not straightforward. It makes our current political situation really understandable, because everybody's kind of at everybody's throats in a way.
Yeah. No, you're right. It's very like Heathers or Disturbing Behavior in that regard. And, you know, when I was in high school, I feel like I was probably like Tolly. I was not plugged into all the groups. I had my group of three or four friends, and we were always like far on the periphery, like looking in at all this stuff going on. And we felt like we were above it, but we weren't above it. We wanted to be part of it. We just weren't invited to the party, you know? But as far as the beginning of this, I didn't actually know it was going to be told in this fashion, at kind of like a series of dramatic monologues a little bit, and also epistolary, and until I started writing it. I knew that I wanted to do something that would fit with the title, I Was a Teenage Slasher. And so I just took off writing, and suddenly Tolly had a name, which I had never heard before, which was fun. And it was weird. It was like, as soon as my pen hit paper, Tolly in La Mesa, Texas in 1989, and this story had been waiting all along. I just had to write really fast to get it down on the page. So I can't remember precisely how I went about, I don't know, creating this high school social landscape, or I didn't have to create La Mesa. I just had to remember La Mesa, but I just remember it felt real to me. And as a writer, that's what you have to do. You have to follow that thread that feels real. And if you can do that, then I think the reader will go along with you. That's my suspicion.
As a reader, one of the things I loved about this book was that you, as you're laying out the rules of the genre, it's just like seeing, you know, for the first time, like reading Dracula for the very first time, or Mary Shelley's Frankenstein, where you see like the rules of a genre being created in real time in front of you by the character, and you realize that the author is doing that, and that contention between the character and the author is really fun. And also, too, the tension it creates between the reader, because we're always kind of leaping ahead of it and saying, okay, he's going to end up here. And it sometimes does and sometimes doesn't. Talk about like creating that tension both between you as the writer and you as the character and the reader trying to like leapfrog around in the narrative.
Yeah, that's one of the most fun things about writing novels. With stories, you have less room to operate in that manner. But with a novel, when you have 400 pages, then you can manipulate the reader's expectations and then sometimes satisfy them, but more often undercut them. But when you undercut them, you have to replace them with something even more satisfying. That's kind of the rule, you know? That's why they're paying whatever dollars they're paying for this book, is because you put the work in to think of something that would be elegant and maybe even poetic in this moment. I'm not talking about language. I'm talking about developments, you know? So that's the job, you know, you've got to do that. If you're a writer, you can't, but at the same time, sometimes the surprise is telling the reader you were right, you guessed who it was or something, you know. And I love that game so much. And within the novel, I Was a Teenage Slasher, Amber and Tali are also trying to figure it out. They are trying, because Amber and her big brother know this slasher genre, they think they can anticipate what's going to happen. But like Jade learned in the Indian Lake trilogy, just because you know the rules doesn't mean you can win the game, you know.
Amber and Tali has such a great relationship. It's so beautifully written, the way it's done and the way you unveil it, lay it out, because the reader sees right away that these two are really essentially a couple and in love, and neither of them is particularly knows that. And so we, on one hand, are seeing one kind of storyline envelop them, while you, on the other hand, are enveloping them in the storyline of the slasher movie. And each of them has their own understanding of the slasher movie. So I love the way that you handle these kind of the expectations of all of the narratives. And it's so much fun just to see character know, Tali, you're an idiot. This is your own best shot.
I know. Yeah, I know. But I think we're all idiots when we're 17. You know, we don't understand what's right in front of us. All these wonderful people in our lives, these fortunate situations we're in, we take it for granted, and we look ahead like, oh, that's going to be better around the corner. You know, we don't understand what we're holding right now. And to me, that is part of that's just part of being that age, and it's a big part of this novel too. It's not quite regret, it's not quite nostalgia. Both of those are kind of part of it, but it's more what you're talking about, kind of just and lack of awareness about where you are and what you have, you know. And I think if Tali could do it different, I mean, we want him to do it different. We want him to just take Amber's hand and run off into the future, you know. But to tell you the truth, I'm not sure he would choose that, because I don't think he thinks he's good enough for Amber, you know?
And what you were describing before, I think, is one of the things this novel captures so well. It's a novel of yearning for something better in your life, and some being able to imagine those things that you can never have, even if you can have them. By virtue of your imagining that you can't, you kind of guarantee that.
Yeah, no, you're the first person to say that, and that encapsulates it so well. It is a novel of yearning. You're right. When you were saying that, I thought, I don't know if you remember, Louis L'Amour used to have a series. He had a book called The Yondering, if I remember correctly, or maybe it was a story in a collection. And but it's got the same build. It's always about I'm reaching, and I don't know. I love that so much. And maybe people always ask me, why do I often write about 17-year-olds? And I think that yearning that you're talking about is a really big part of that, you know?
Well, I'm looking at this novel from 50 years beyond 17, and I can tell you as a fact that my understanding of the American male is that we exist in a quantum state between 17 and 77. And whenever you look at us, we're either acting like our 17-year-old selves or 77-year-old selves.
But if you're talking quantum stuff, then those two selves are entangled too, you know, forever. Yeah,
Exactly,
they're
for forever.
inextricably entangled.
Now, the inciting incident in this novel involves a big high school party where a lot of young kids are getting drunk. It also involves a peanut allergy. Do you suffer from allergies?
Not from a peanut allergy. I am allergic to everything in the onion family, and I'm like terribly, terribly lactose intolerant. Like the other day on a plane, I thought I could eat some almonds that had a white coating on them. It said that they were lemon coated, and so I thought I can eat that, but it turns out they were yogurt, and so I was just sick as could be. Like even that much dairy just kills me. I can't, but I don't react like it's not life threatening as it as a peanut allergy is with Tali. You know, it's more like this sucks, you know.
One of the things I like is are the groups and the niches and the group led by Deke. Talk about creating these different groups in, you know, a small setting. This is a small town, but it feels like, you know, it feels like my high school did back in whenever I was in high school.
Yeah, I mean, for most slashers, at least if it's going to be a revenge type slasher, needs a group of entitled people such that they can somehow be dismissive of another person's like self, of their personhood, you know? And so many slashers start out that way, with them pulling some prank or doing some crime and not being punished. So I knew I needed that set. So that was Deke's set. But also, it was really fun for me to establish the marching band set, you know, and the baton twirlers were part of that. And in a small town, I mean, maybe I'm not sure how it is at a big school. I never went to like a big city school, but in small towns, the marching band people are a real group. You know, they hang together. They protect each other. They've got to, because they wear all those big ostrich feathers and stuff and the weird epaulets on their shoulders. So they have to stick together because they're going to look weird individually, you know. And then there's also the FFA crowd, which I was part of the FFA crowd. That's the only group I was in for a couple of years anyways. Let's see, freshman and sophomore year. And that's a totally different set. And my wife tells me, she grew up around Houston, that at her school, being an FFA was not cool. But at my school in West Texas, being an FFA was the coolest. You know, you had to be an FFA. You had to be in Future Farmers of America or Future Homemakers of America, FHA. And so it's just different like value systems at different schools and different regions, of course. Let me think. So there's FFA. There's Deke's kind of athletic crew. There's the marching band. And then outside of all of them are Tali and Amber, the outsiders, you know? And I think outsiders is who I write about best, just because I always was an outsider, because I grew up moving from school to school. And so I was always the new kid on the playground or the new kid in the cafeteria or whatever, and having to prove myself or having to suffer various things, you know? So outsiderness is something I feel like I understand fairly well anyways.
One of the great invention of this book is to give rules to the creation of the quote slasher in the same way, so that it joins the legion of horror monsters like werewolves and vampires that have definite rules on how they get created, what they can do, how it happens. And I just think that was so brilliant. I thank you for doing that, because
thank you.
I was just so tired of, you know, these marching killing machines. Now we have that same kind of rules. Talk about did you create the rules as you went, or did you decide upon them early on and then wind your way through the preset field?
I think I decided on them about a quarter of the way through. I realized I can't just be hodgepodge with this. It's got to be systematic, you know? And so I did stop writing for a day or two and think about all the slashers in my head that I've watched and read and distill those down to the basic characteristics. And then I had to figure out how those characteristics going to both express themselves through Tali, and how are they going to impact the story? How are they going to change the way the plot goes and the development goes? And but you're right. Like the werewolf didn't get codified in that fashion until 1941 with the Wolfman. And then the zombie kind of got codified that way with Romero in 68. And then John Carpenter in 78 with Halloween codified the formula of the slasher, but not necessarily the characteristics of the slasher itself, of the genre. He did that really well, you know? And so, yeah, with I Was a Teenage Slasher, I am kind of using whatever blade I have to carve off the excess from the slasher and show it as a lean, clean killing machine, you know?
Well, one thing that really makes this book stand out for me was the prose in it. I just love reading every sentence, and I felt like I was in the hand of like a super quality writer. I feel like this is a book that is going to stand long, you know, Huck Finn and some of these other books, as really giving insight into the psychology of the time and by using the elements of the fantastic. Does this prose just roll off the end of your fingers when you type?
Pretty much, yeah. I mean, I'm not saying I'm super talented or anything, but I have always been lucky as far as writing goes. And, but for Tolly to be able to like put on the page the prose he does through this computer that doesn't even have a word processing program, I had to establish him as a former ready writing champion in the UIL system of Texas. Maybe it's elsewhere, I'm not sure. But, and I really know UIL ready writing well, because for years, probably from about 2000 until probably about 2007, 2008, I was a ready writing judge all over West Texas. That's what I'd do with my Saturdays. I would go to different little schools and students would write essays and I would score them and we'd have winners and they'd move on to the next level and everything. So I got really pretty intimately involved with ready writing, and that's why I let him be a ready writer. He's not good at anything else, but he can write, you know?
Well, I have to say that all that time you spent in the small schools judging ready writers must have definitely gave you a lot of insight into the mind of the teenagers that made writing this book a lot easier.
You're totally right about that. It did. Not just teenagers, but West Texas teenagers, you know? Yeah.
This is a very Texas book. And one of the things I loved about reading it was it took me back to the early days. Back in 1989, I was working in Playa del Rey and living in Garden Grove. And once a week, I would allow myself to go to a bookstore in Fullerton called the Aladdin Books, where I would buy like a limited edition, a Dark Harvest hardcover or something. And I was a big fan then of Joe R. Lansdale. And so I thought, you know, he's a Texas guy and has had a lot of Texas in his books. And also his story, Lord of the Razor. And the other fellow that I like, and I actually met him at Aladdin Books in downtown Fullerton, was a fellow named Richard Lehman. And so these are book guys who both, especially Richard Lehman, took very simple stories. I mean, they were not rocket science, but he invested a lot of heart in them. And so I'd like you to talk about taking, you know, a novel like I Was a Teenage Slasher. You look at the title and you think, well, this will be fun and entertaining. But when I read it, I just was just astounded by how deep it felt, how heartfelt it was, that yearning that you build into it. Talk about, you know, just the genre of yearning horror novels.
Yeah, that's one of my favorite things to do with a novel is to present it as this is going to be pulpy, it's going to be schlocky. You've seen this 600 times before, but then ambush the reader with, oh wow, this actually has heart. This has some sort of artistic component to it, you know? That's one of my favorite things to do. And I think it comes from, I want to say it comes from Stanislaw Lem's write-up of Philip K. Dick's work, where he's talking about how he's kind of taking PKD to task, you know, and saying he has talent, but why is he operating in these fetid gutters, you know, or and that kind of stuff. That's my memory of it. I haven't read that. You know it?
Oh, absolutely. One of my main mindset makers as I approach science fiction.
It's one of my main mindset makers too, just for how I approach all fiction. And I think that's why I like to also play in what a lot of writers consider the gutter, because I want to prove that amazing stuff happens. It's not about your genre, it's about how much heart you put into it, you know?
And that's one of the things that, again, as I read this book, the feel, you know, there's a, you talked about the ready writing, and I think that kind of like confessional diary format works really well for this. And I love that Tolly, it seems like he's very passive aggressive. He ends a lot of his sentences with questions, which I thought, even when he's making a statement, talk about using that kind of format, which I thought was very interesting.
Oh, thank you. You know, that's kind of how we speak in West Texas, is with a lot of questions like that. And the reason we do it is because there's a lot of violence. I mean, there's violence in the whole world, but I grew up in West Texas, so it feels to me like there was a lot of violence in West Texas. And so you always had to, you wouldn't ever say anything directly to anyone. You would go way around the house and say it in a quiet way behind the bush over here, you know, and maybe they hear it, maybe they don't. And another way of going around the house is to put question marks at the end of your sentences. It's not actually asking a question, but it's like signaling to the listener that this is not confrontational. You know, it's a way of avoiding violence, of avoiding fights. And Tali, he's not a big guy. He's not tough. And so I think he is going to, by default, speak like that every chance he gets, because he doesn't want to get beat up, you know?
Again, that's one of the lovely parts of this book, is that he's the guy who's usually on the receiving end of the beating. And he, by virtue of becoming a slasher in a way that we'll let the readers discover, because it's totally joyous and fun, he becomes, you know, this avatar of ultimate violence, which you describe so well. Talk about, do you have a lot of fun thinking of like the various set pieces you create in this book? Because there are some places where it's both awful and hilarious at the same time.
Oh, thank you so much. I do have a lot of fun doing that. And I don't have to try very hard. To me, the violent set pieces, they come so naturally. It's the parts of the novels I always have difficulty with are the between parts. Like, the violent set pieces are easy, but the stringing a story from set piece violence H over to set piece violence I, that middle part is tricky for me. That's always like my big question with writing novels when I started out writing. And my first one, I wrote it in 98, I guess, was, how do you do the boring parts? You know, I just want it all to be car races and bear fights and stuff. But I know that you can't stay at that same screechy level. You have to have variation. You have to go up and down. And so those down parts, when you're in the valley of the narrative, those are the tricky parts for me. How do you still make it propulsive, you know, and interesting?
Well, what I have to ask is, did your first novel have bear fights and car races?
My first novel had a lot of fast cars, a lot of chases by people chasing, like police officers chasing you, and it had giant coyotes, and it had a submarine in the desert, and it had my favorite scene in that novel. It's the Fast Red Road. Is these two guys have a sword fight all this one afternoon, but the way they have the sword fight is, they use their right hand with a sword, and their left hand, they're hanging from the roof of a rest stop that's like a carport. It's like open air. And so they're just having a big sword fight around and around in this rest stop. And that's one of my favorite scenes I've ever written, probably.
You know, I think one thing that's obvious as we speak is that you have a lot of fun writing your novels, and that comes across, and that's why the readers are able to have fun. Even when you're heading into the parts you call boring, your ability to yearn, and I think this is also done in the Indian Linker trilogy too. There's a line in an old song, Carly Simon song, Anticipation, which is, she goes out on it, these are the good old days. And I think that line, I hear that refrain as I read your novels, that, you know, all this blood, all this awful stuff that's happening, these declines, but these are the things that make us who we are. And if we are, if we still are at the end of anything, then those are good days.
I totally agree with that 100%. I'm so glad you see that in some fashion in what I write, because I completely subscribe to that. Yes. And I try to always remember that when, like, I'm broke down on the side of the road, at the moment, it's a lot of trouble. I'm late somewhere. I'm going to have to pay X amount of dollars to get this fixed and all. But I know that in 5 years, I'm going to look back to sit down the side of that road and it's going to be a pretty good time. It's going to be the good old days, you know?
As you, one of the things I love in this book is your sense of story, because there's two stories that are overlapping. There's the template of the slasher, which you are creating as your characters are discovering, and then there's the template of the teenage love story and the teenage outsiders trying to get through their teenage year story. Talk about using those kind of narratives and the way that you balance the two. You coming out of one, you go into another.
Yeah, I think I was talking about how to get through the boring parts, and I think that in this novel, not all my novels, but in this novel, that's how I do that. Like the parts between the violent set pieces are the coming of age slash love story parts, And to tell you, and those, they didn't come quite as easily as the set pieces, but I found myself probably more invested in them at the same time, because I wanted a happy ending for these two so badly, And maybe I should write romances because then I could do that. But I write horror, so I know that this is probably going to go pretty far south,
Well, thank you for writing horror because it makes the romance all that much more poignant, I think.
Thank you. Oh, thank you. Well, to tell you the truth, I've always felt that the slasher and the romantic comedy, anyways, are the same exact thing. They have the same beats. It's just what counts as gore in one is like a makeout scene in the other, or a meet cute or something. But I feel like they are two sides of the same coin. They follow the same development patterns.
Has this been snapped up to become a movie? I mean, it already sounds like a movie.
I'm having a meeting really soon with a director about it, so we'll see what happens. Yeah,
I
but
would.
that'd be cool for me. My only, I say my only, one of my requests, if it does get adapted, will be, can we please shoot it, or at least shoot some of it in West Texas? Because so many West Texas movies get shot outside of Los Angeles, and those of us from West Texas know that that's not West Texas. It doesn't look like West Texas,
The San Fernando Valley is essentially most of the world, according to Hollywood.
it is, isn't it?
As I read this novel, one of the things that struck me was your deep knowledge of the landscape and the layout of the town. This is based on a real town. Have the people of La Mesa read this novel yet?
I ran into, in my book event I did on tour in San Antonio, there were two readers there from La Mesa, which was amazing to me. And then I've signed, I think, two of them for readers who came through the signing line for friends they have that are from La Mesa. So people from La Mesa are reading it. And also, when I was writing it, I had to lean on a friend I have there, Travis Burkett, and he lives there. He grew up there, and he's seen it change over the years. So he helped me a lot. He like looked up old high school yearbooks and took pictures of marching band uniforms and just told me like I didn't grow up in La Mesa. I grew up probably 45 miles south of La Mesa. So like what we call 137, they call the Stanton Highway. And so I had to get those kind of things right too. And he helped me with that because I didn't want to mess up. I wanted to get La Mesa as right as I could. But at the same time, I always follow Richard Hugo's dictum in Triggering Town, his book on writing poetry. It's a craft book, a little bitty skinny thing. And he says in that, if you're writing your story in a small town, then yeah, get that intersection where St. Francis meets Main Street right. But if the water tower is on the west side of town and your story needs it to be on the east side of town, then move that water tower because the story has to be the first thing. If the story beats, the story is more important than strict accuracy.
Well, I think by virtue of the fact of writing a powerful story, it recreates the location. It sweeps the reader's mind along. And I think that, too, that's one of the things that as much as I like for books to be turned into movies somewhat, mm-hmm. I don't think they can ever live up to the reading experience, because the power of this book is just the power of reading Tolly's voice. It's mm-hmm. a joy to experience. And as a writer, it's like kind of, I think of it as close to a method acting. Do you mm-hmm. find yourself still thinking like Tolly?
I do, and it's funny you mentioned method acting, because that's always one of my big pushes, is that's how I write. I'm a method writer. I imagine what it's like to be Tolly, 5'9", 140 pounds, an outsider, and then I look around, and what do I do now that I'm here in this room, in this field, in this party, wherever I am? And that's exactly how that's the only way I know to write. So I'll probably just keep doing that, I think.
In the fullness of time, I'm wondering if you'll you leave the door open to come back to this character.
It could happen. I think I'll probably let this be a standalone, but you never can tell. Maybe I have some idea. Like, you know, I think that movie Black Phone, based on the Joe Hill story that Scott Derrickson directed, was meant to be a standalone, but then Joe Hill had a crazy idea and it opened up into a sequel. So who knows what will happen. But I think for now, my big plan is to let it be over.
Also, I think too that between the Indian Lake trilogy and mm-hmm. this novel and The Only Good Indians, it's my feeling that, you know, you've become like a major American author alongside the likes of Richard Ford and along those, you know, Twain, the people who mm-hmm. like help define the country, and Stephen King as well. So talk about, you know, I think that one of the things that's happening is that horror is becoming seen less as a niche and a genre and more mm-hmm. as just a literature.
Mm-hmm. No, I totally agree with that. And we're talking about outsiders. Horror has always been the outsider. We're the ones not in the big tent. We're in a little tent at this crazy carnival. And we sometimes look into through the flap of the big tent and see the things going on, but we know that's not for us. But you're right. Over the last probably 5-6 years, maybe even since Jordan Peele's Get Out back in, 2016, I feel like horror has been getting more and more legitimate, more and more accepted, you know? Like, people aren't as embarrassed to say they like horror now as they used to be. And I'm thrilled with that. Thrilled with that and also scared of that, you know, because being an outsider has always been part of our identity. That gives us solidarity. We're like, oh, they don't like us, we like each other, we'll stick together better, you know? And so I wonder how horror is going to carry itself in this new world where it's in the big tent now, you know? How's it going to be different?
Well, this too makes me think too that over the long haul, I've noticed that the horror genre becomes prominent, becomes strong, and gets a lot of vision during bad economic times.
And I'm wondering
if you, as a writer of horror, have any thoughts about why that is.
I think it's because we like our media, or we're drawn to media that can serve as a funhouse mirror for the anxieties and issues we see in our lives, in our world. And so in times of economic downturn, political strife, maybe the environment collapsing, or all this at once and more, then we turn to media that processes us through those anxieties, those fears, those emotions. And the wonderful thing about horror, whether it's on the screen, on the page, in a painting, in a poem, wherever it is it starts and then it ends. Unlike the COVID pandemic, it's now endemic. You know, it doesn't have an ending in sight. And all the political situation we've been in, that seems to, instead of tailing off to a natural end, it just gets bigger and crazier, you know? But when we turn to horror does have a light at the end of that tunnel that we can walk out into. I mean, sometimes it's a train coming at you. That's how some horror is. But more often than not, you finally slouch out of that long, dark, terrible, loud, scary tunnel into a moment of daylight, you know? And that's what we like, are those moments of daylight, I think.
The horror genre, it one of the things that's interesting is how strong it is in both the film world and the written world. And there's a lot of cross-pollination and, influence up to back and forth. And I don't think that's exactly the case with, for example, science fiction or even just everyday, normal rom-coms, et cetera. Could you talk about that pollination? And as a guy who's on one side of it, how, I mean, your books are all, really based on people who know the film genre.
Yeah, you're told. I hadn't thought about that. You're right. The slasher, for example, grew up and evolved in the cinema, and so it kind of developed cinematic techniques. They're baked into the slasher genre. And to tell you the truth, like the vampire wasn't allergic to sunlight until Nosferatu, and back in what, 1922 or something. And you're right with horror and film. Things do get handed off from the box office to the bookshelf and back and forth and back and forth. And I think that that allows it to grow stronger, you know? Like you're right that science fiction does seem to, like, I think science fiction, it's not locked to the bookshelf, but I think that's where it finds its best expression, you know? But then you have like successes in science fiction, like The Expanse television series or Interstellar or something, and that serves less as like cross-pollination and more as like a lighthouse, a beacon to follow, to move towards, you know, and that's wonderful too. But yeah, you're right. Horror is always handing itself and its techniques and its conventions and its characters back and forth from the bookshelf to the box office.
You are a superb writer of novels and short stories. Have you considered pitching and writing a screenplay from in screenplay format? Have you done that?
I love writing screenplays. Yeah, I've been hired to write screenplays, and I've been in writers' rooms for television shows, and it's all fun. I mean, Hollywood's it's a good time, but I think I belong in book world actually, 'cause that's where I grew up, and I just know the process of development that a novel takes probably better than I understand all the many, many factors that go into creating a feature or a television show. And it's just, I feel more natural on the page, on the fiction page, than I do on the in a writer's room or working for someone to write a feature. But that's not to say I don't love writing screenplays. I probably like writing screenplays, feature films, more than I like writing television episodes, I think. Even though I totally understand that in TV land, the writer is actually important. In movie land, at the box office, the writer is the least important person generally. But I love writing screenplays. And what I love about it is that it's so wildly different than writing prose fiction. And, you know, a whole lot of prose fiction writers will try to write a screenplay and they think it's all about formatting, just making it fit into this shape. That's not what it is at all. It's a different way of expressing. It's you have to bring everything to the surface, either visually or through dialogue, and that makes for a completely different story. And I love doing that. It's totally a ball.
Well, this novel is a great, vision of that because on one hand, it looks as you read it and you see as you read it, you kind of experience it like a slasher movie. You see it in your brain like that, and the plot plays out in some ways like that. But it's all Holly's voice, which is the interior. I mean, you've made turning that into this movie into a screen or this book into a screenplay. It, on one hand, it would seem simple. On the other hand, when you start to think about it, no. The joy in this is all understanding who Tali is and how do you do that?
No, I totally agree. That's going to be the trick. I mean, the knee-jerk way to do it, which may be the way to do it, I'm not sure, is to give it some voiceover like the Wonder Years, you know, or like Dexter often, the television show Dexter often had voiceover as well. And that can totally work. It's kind of like a caption in a comic book. That's how the voiceover works and features. And maybe that's the way to go. I don't know. But I do agree that if in the eventual adaptation of I Was a Teenage Slasher, the only time we hear Tully's voice is when he's speaking dialogue, that's gonna feel like there's a lot missing, you know?
What the TV show did you work on?
Oh, I don't think I can say it, it.
Oh.
We did the pilot. We did the pilot, and then it didn't get picked up. So it was somebody else's project. So I feel like I shouldn't talk about it, you know?
Well, that's understandable.
Yeah.
And
Oh,
that.
I guess I've done that twice, really. I was on another television show. Well, I can say this one. I was supposed to be in the, or I was going to be in the writer's room of the Friday the 13th television show that was trying to happen, but I couldn't end up making the scheduling work, so I became a consultant for that, which was nothing but fun, of course. But then that just got canceled, what, a month ago, maybe something like that.
The Friday the 13th TV show?
Yeah,
Oh, wow. I didn't even know there was such a thing. I remember that there was a series of many years ago where they had an antique shop or something.
They did it, and it was a haunted items kind of,
Right. Yeah. And you worked on that?
Yeah, it wasn't like that. It was actually dealing with Jason Voorhees and
Oh.
everything. Yeah, so it was, I mean, yeah, it was gonna be fun, and there was really talented, capable people on it. But that's the way it is with Hollywood productions. Like some of them, for reasons that no one can clearly identify, they just kind of turn to smoke, you know?
Well, that's the great advantage of the novel is
I
that
agree.
you start out on it, and so long as you can stay in the chair, it
Yeah.
gets finished.
Exactly. And even if the publisher goes away or for some reason they kick you out, you still got that manuscript and you can resell it somewhere else, you know?
Are you working on a new work now, new novel?
I just now turned in my revision for the Buffalo Hunter Hunter, a vampire, historical epistolary vampire novel I have coming out March 18th, 2025, I guess. And I just now got notes for a novel I have coming out in fall 2025.
This is fantastic news. I can't wait to read that. As a writer, that's an unusually brisk schedule. Talk about, making the getting in the contracts to do that, making the commitments to do that, filling it out. That it seems they're letting you go more often than most writers that you have traditionally have.
They are, yeah. And back in 02, there was a publisher who wanted me to write thrillers for them, and they said, "You'll do one thriller a year for good money." And I was like, "All right, I'll do that, but I'm also going to do a science fiction novel, a fantasy novel, a horror novel, a literary novel. I'm going to do a lot of other novels besides." And they said, "No, you're just doing one novel." And so we broke up because I can't even imagine being throttled back like that, you know? In 2014, when I got with my current agent, she said, "You've been publishing too many novels," because I had a few years where I did like four novels each year. And I think I might have done five novels in 1 year or five books in 1 year, anyways. And she said, "That's too many books." And she said, "You're going to do at most one book a year," which broke my heart. I'm like, how am I ever going to write that little, you know? But we did that for a while. But yeah, now we're back up to two books a year. And two books a year is pretty comfortable for me. There's like pre-promotion, and then there's tours, and that takes up a lot of time, you know? So I think two is a good amount for me to handle every year.
And does this include other media working in movies too?
It did for a while. That's how I was able to throttle myself back, was I signed on to, or I finally accepted some of the invites from Hollywood. And also I wrote the comic book Earth Divers for a year and a half, 2 years or something, and that took up a lot of time as well. But Earth Divers is now going over, and I'm not currently on any Hollywood productions. I mean, I'm exec producer on things that are trying to happen, but who knows? That's not really at this moment a lot of work for me, so I can focus more on writing novels. Just random novels I want to write, and also teaching. I'm a professor at University of Colorado Boulder, and I'm excited about the courses I'm teaching this year. I'm getting to teach a grad seminar on the possession narrative, like everything from The Exorcist up through Paul Tremblay and Grady Hendrix and Christopher Golden's recent one, The House of Last Resort, all that kind of stuff. It's all research for me because I want to write a possession novel, but I want to understand how exactly the possession novel works. That's how, like, I used to teach a slasher course. That's how I figured out how slashers work. I used to teach a werewolf course, and then I wrote Mongrels. I taught a haunted house course, then I did The Babysitter Lives. I taught a found footage fiction course, and then I wrote I Was a Teenage Slasher, and I taught a grad seminar on the vampire, and then I wrote The Buffalo Hunter Hunter. So, yeah, I like teaching. I like being in a room and getting to talk to smart people about things that we all care about, you know? And then in the spring, is it the spring? No. Yeah, in the spring, I'm teaching a lecture course to like 250 students on monsters. And so we'll have different units. We'll go from the vampire to the werewolf, to demons, and maybe we might even do kaiju. I don't know. We're gonna probably have 2 or 3 week units, and that's gonna be hugely educational for me and hopefully for the class.
Boy, that sounds like really fun, and college has become a fun place. I was lucky to get to I had Oakley Hall as my teacher back at UCI, who wrote some good westerns, and he taught us about the Peloponnesian War. That was Which was that's about as exciting as things got in Irvine in 1975. So, and I noticed too that part of this was written at the Stanley Hotel, the famous Stanley Hotel.
I used to teach a fiction workshop out there, but I guess this part was I got invited to a charity event out there. I forget what it's called now, but we got to, it was a heat, there was probably 200 people there, and it was just a series of us up on stage doing our thing and then interacting with everyone. And that was a really good time. I'll start over. I've been at the Stanley a lot of times for the fiction workshop I used to teach there, but for that charity event. And then back in 2015, I got called there as like a meeting of the horror minds thing because the Stanley had just gotten a grant and they pulled in different people from all media of horror to talk about what's good to do with money for horror, you know? But it's cool when I go out there. Sometimes they stash me in 217. That's a fun room to stay in.
I've been speaking with Stephen Graham Jones. His new novel is I Was a Teenage Slasher. Thank you for joining me, Stephen.
Man, it was great talking to you. It always is. Thank you for having me.
You're listening to the Agony Column News Report, featuring interviews, phone interviews, reports from live book events and festivals, and conversations with readers. You can find additional news, interviews, book reviews, and more 5 days a week at the Agony Column website at trashotron.com/agony.